Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Georgia Senator Sam Nunn established an impressive record for one who worked without the charisma many thought essential to success in Washington. When the senator decided to retire, syndicated columnist George Will concluded his retrospective on Sam Nunn's career with, "The Georgia Democrat is among the best presidents this nation never had." My guest today was there on the day a 33-year-old Sam Nunn announced his intention to enter the U.S. Senate race. Roland McElroy was a key participant in Georgia State Representative Sam Nunn's first election to the U.S. Senate in 1972. Their working relationship continued in Washington, D.C., where Roland McElroy served as press secretary and later chief of staff during his 15 years with Nunn. Roland McElroy holds degrees in economics and journalism from the University of Georgia and supported himself during his time as a student by working at radio stations in Athens, Georgia. Roland McElroy has now written a memoir of his working with Sam Nunn, the best president this nation never had. The book chronicles the journey that he took with Sam Nunn as he presented a message of common sense conservatism to the voters of Georgia. Nunn's principled approach to making government work through cooperation and compromise, and his demonstrated mastery of complex issues, placed him among a rare few considered every 4 years for the highest office in the land. Roland McElroy, welcome.
Hi, glad to be with you.
I want you to describe the cover of your book, because it has a photograph on there that I found very appropriate.
Oh, my. That photograph, I think it was made in 1973, late 73, or possibly 74. It may also have been on the day that Vice President Agnew resigned his office, it could very well be. I don't have a date on that, but that's a good enough day because the serious expression on my face and on his, as a matter of fact, both of us in dismay and disbelief. And I remember saying to him as we were coming down those steps.
Yeah, you're standing on the Capitol Hill, the steps of the Capitol building. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I said to him, "Can you believe it? The vice president has resigned." And I said, "You know, if we stay here another 30 years, we're not likely to see anything as incredibly unbelievable as this." And I remember that he sort of smiled and looked at me and he said, "Well, maybe we should both stay tuned." And that was the way we got started, at least with the excitement of Washington, of which there has been much more since then, of course.
Well, just, I don't know if I'm the only one that noticed that, but the two of you look so, you have similar haircuts, similar glasses. You could be pass for brothers. Anybody else think the two of you resemble each other?
It's amazing that you have made that observation just from that one photo. That happened all the time to us.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, I really did enjoy your book because, for one thing, you have a heartwarming and inspiring foreword written by Sam Nunn. And in it, he compliments you. He says, "Roland McElroy was with me from the very beginning as my key communications strategist and spokesperson. He became an invaluable advisor and confidant and played an indispensable role in both my 1972 campaign and my Senate career." And so he says he's grateful for your longstanding friendship. I thought that was, he had some very nice words to say about you. And then, do you remember what how he concludes his foreword to your book?
I'm not sure.
He says that he's happy you wrote this book, really. He says, "I'm hopeful that a potential young leader will read this book and find useful lessons to guide their path. He or she will be very fortunate if they have a friend and partner like Roland McElroy."
He was altogether too generous when he wrote that. We both have, however, I would say, a similar approach to politics and what it takes to be a good representative in this republic, and so we were in sync from day one. And I appreciate everything that he had to say there. I hope other people will read this book, and when they do, they'll come away with a better idea of exactly what it takes, what qualities are important to being successful in the Congress, in the House, Senate, or even as a president.
Well, let me remind listeners of the title of your book, The Best President the Nation Never Had, A Memoir of Working with Sam Nunn. And I love the behind-the-scenes workings of things that we never would imagine involved in. Well, you didn't imagine either, because you mentioned how naive you were when you stepped into this role. Well, you mentioned that you and Sam saw eye to eye on so many things. And in many ways, you had similar backgrounds. You both grew up not that many miles from each other. And I particularly enjoyed your description of what it was like to grow up in the South at that time, because I was once asked by a friend who grew up in Brooklyn, that he said he couldn't imagine what it was like to grow up in the South. And I couldn't really convey that what it was like the way you did. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooks County, about 10 miles from the Florida line. And there was a good reason it was called the breadbasket of the Confederacy, which it was indeed during the Civil War. You can grow just about anything you want there. I remember telling someone that once, and they said, "Do you grow blueberries?" And we didn't at that time. The next time I went home to Brooks County, there was a field of blueberries right in front of me. And my dad used to talk about it as the site of the original Garden of Eden. And he always got a good laugh out of that. But as time goes by, I think more and more that he might have been right. The soil is rich and you can grow just about everything you can there. The Confederacy also grew well there, apparently. And they had April 26th, they had a standard event in which they celebrated the Confederate War, the Civil War, the war between the states. And they had all of the young people in elementary school bring flowers to school, and then they would march two by two to the local cemetery where all the Confederate veterans were buried, and we were instructed to put the flowers on the graves of the Confederates. I remember asking my teacher, "How will we know? How will we know which graves belong to the Confederates?" And she said, "Oh, it'll be easy. They'll all have a Confederate flag on them." And indeed, she was right. They did all have that very flag. And there was always a special ceremony presented there at the time by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And the young children were encouraged in school to write essays about some Civil War hero from the South. And they would give you a choice. I remember once I wrote about Nathan Bedford Forrest. And if you wrote an essay that was good enough, they would award you $2 silver at that cemetery event. And so I was pleased to win it at least one time, only later that I began to realize that this is part of the indoctrination, if you will, of a point of view regarding the Confederacy. And it perhaps helps you to help shape one to put it all in perspective, all the difficulties we've had over the years in our society, if you have grown up in that environment. And I consider it a benefit of having grown up there. Not that I agree with anything that the Confederacy stood for, but it was good to have a personal experience in that history, in that time period.
Well, I admit that I grew up in the same town that you did, Roland, and you were a year ahead of me, and I happened to have won those silver dollars in that essay contest also. And I was curious if do you remember your pen name? Because I came up with something very unimaginative. I signed it Scarlett O'Hara.
Well, mine was not very imaginative either. I think it was Daddy Warbucks or something like that. My sister wrote one, and she had a better pen name. It was Petunia Potts.
Well, and I felt like you did too. It was just something you did. You went down, you put flowers on the Confederate graves, and you wrote an essay. But, you know, there was something interesting that I, at the time, didn't understand why they instructed us to say, to use the term war between the states. What I didn't understand is they were telling us, don't call it the Civil War. Do you remember that?
Oh, I definitely do. And I didn't think anything of it at the time. I just thought, all right, well, whatever. That's the way everybody looks at it. It's the war between the states. And it was quite some time later before I realized it was actually officially called the Civil War.
Yeah.
But that's part of our growing up.
Well, I might remind readers, my guest is Roland McElroy. His book is The Best President the Nation Never Had, a memoir of working with Sam Nunn. And Roland was just telling us that he grew up not that far from Sam Nunn's hometown. And the name of our hometown was Quitman. And you mentioned in your book that there were several Quitmans named for this hero. And in Texas, there was a smaller town of Quitman. Did you know, Roland, that Sissy Spacek was from Quitman, Texas?
No, I did not know that. Yes. There are five towns in the South that have General Quitman's name, and I did not know that. Yeah.
Well, you've just been telling us about your time growing up, and how did you learn about Sam Nunn's early life?
Oh, my. After we began our association, I guess back in 1971, 72, I had the opportunity to be in Perry, Georgia, his hometown, and begin a dialogue with the local residents, pastors, teachers, friends for life, and others who knew him. And after talking with them, I discovered that, frankly, his growing up years were not that dissimilar from mine. And it was great to realize that he had a similar experience and now I was going to have an opportunity to grow with them as he began his public service career. That's how I first became acquainted with Perry and the people there who were such strong supporters. In fact, he was not known very well outside of the county of Houston County, where Perry is located. When he started the race, and I wondered how in the world he was going to crack that identity problem and break it open. Well, it was the people of Perry who did it. Everybody in town, whether you run the hardware store or funeral home director or the auto dealership, they all had friends and connections around the state. I remember the county clerk had a long list of people. They would come into our little campaign headquarters in the heart of downtown Perry and write letters to their counterpart all across the state. And those people, wherever we went, they would come up and say, you know, I don't know anything about you, Sam Nunn, but so-and-so speaks very highly of you, and that's good enough for me. I'm going to support you. And that's the way it often started in counties. And it helped us tremendously from the very beginning in finding key supporters and in finding people who would agree to be the local county coordinator for us. So it's been a great experience for me over the years to meet all of the people of Perry and to be a witness to how much they really supported him then and, of course, to this very day.
Well, Sam Nunn was not the first in his family to go into public service. Who was Mayor Sam Nunn?
Mayor Sam Nunn was his father, Sam Nunn Sr. And I think he married late in life, and he was about 50 years of age when Sam Nunn Jr. was born in 1938. And he was the mayor. He was also very much involved in Democratic politics in the state. He was chairman of the delegation to the 1924, and I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, the 1928 Democratic convention. One of those had 102 ballots before they finally selected the nominee. But it was a different world, and politics worked very differently, and selections for nominees were often made in back rooms filled with lots of smoke. But his father was very much involved in Georgia Democratic politics, and so was his great uncle, or his grand uncle, we say, Carl Vinson, on his mother's side of the family. And so, I mean, he spent his early years listening to his dad and Representative Carl Vinson, who served 50 years from the state of Georgia, representing the district around Milledgeville. And he had plenty of opportunity to listen to them talk about world affairs and national defense. And I think it was from those early conversations that he began to whet an appetite for public service, and in particular, serving in the Congress.
Well, I might mention that Carl Vinson got a lot of honors for his leadership in Congress, but the highest was President Nixon traveled to Georgia in 1973, and this was Uncle Carl's 90th birthday, and on that day he announced that the next nuclear-powered aircraft carrier would be named the USS Carl Vinson. So that's quite an honor that within Sam Nunn's family.
It really is. At that time, he was the first living American to have an aircraft carrier named for him. And so it was quite an honor. And I don't know that I can add much to that, except that it was a day I'll never forget.
My guest is Roland McElroy. His book is The Best President the Nation Never Had, a memoir of working with Sam Nunn. You talked earlier about you and Sam Nunn had similar experiences growing up in similar towns. And I might mention, for people who aren't very familiar with the South, these towns, Perry and Quitman, were not Mayberry kind of Southern towns. Quitman actually, as I see now, had some degree of sophistication. We valued music. There were women who made sure the parks were well cared for and full of azaleas. But there was racism then. And you include some anecdotes in your book. Why did you include your reflections on racism in your memoir?
Because as I developed a narrative arc for this story, I realized that both Sam Nunn and I lived in towns where racism was an important part of the environment in which young people were growing up. It was a very Christian community, and yet you had this element that still believed that black people should be in their place. I worked as a yard boy for a couple of the ladies in Quitman who lived out on North Court Street, very distinguished part of town. They referred to blacks as darkies. And I never had heard the expression before, but they were Christian people who went to church every Sunday and had no problem calling them by other names as well. But that was the way they had always heard it. That was the culture they came from. And here I was hearing it all again, sometimes, I guess, for the first time, and becoming used to it, which is not a good thing to do. But that's what we were all doing in those days. Quitman is a lovely town, and I really think the good things from it are worthy of special note, Nancy. Yeah. The background there was wonderful for both of us. I think we got a sound foundation in everything, from music to literature, and that's really what it was, a foundation that enabled us to go from there to various colleges and universities and become better people.
Yeah. In fact, since you mentioned going off to university, you actually started right as soon as you graduated. You went off to the University of Georgia. And so in 1962, you were 18 years old. Sam Nunn was finishing law school. He was 24 years old. And then what did he do after he finished law school?
Well, after he finished law school, he went into the Coast Guard for a short while, about 6 months, I guess it was, and then, of course, reserve duty for 6 years. But and soon thereafter, after he finished his 6 months of service, he began working for the House Armed Services Committee. His great uncle was the chairman of that committee and hired him to do some work for the group as a staff attorney. Actually, that's where his interest in nuclear proliferation, or reducing the spread of nuclear weapons around the world, began. He was on a congressional delegation, a CODEL they call it, visit to France the fall of 1962 when the Cuban Missile Crisis took place. And I think it left an indelible imprint on him. I remember in his the story he told me was he was at Ramstein Air Force Base when the whole thing came about.
And, in Germany.
Yes, Ramstein in Germany. And the commanding general there, talking with him, emphasized that he would have only a few minutes to get his aircraft off the ground if the Russians, or the Soviets at that time we called them, had decided to launch an attack against America. He, to make a long story short, he resolved that if he ever had the opportunity to do something to reduce the expansion of nuclear weapons around the world, that he would do it. He would take that opportunity. A lot of people, in looking at his career and listening to him, don't realize that that's an overarching theme in virtually everything that he did. It was in his first speech. It was in his last speech. I remember reviewing his reelection speech in 1978 as I was preparing for this book, and there he had it again. I mean, we were fighting inflation at that time and other things. Economic issues were of prime importance to the country. And he did. He talked about those problems as well. But he also got in that comment about the need to control the spread of nuclear weapons. And it's all a part of his entire 24 years of service in the U.S. Senate.
In fact, you quote him when he was asked years later to reflect on the events of that October and the impact on his life. Sam Nunn says, "I made a decision that if I ever had an opportunity to help reduce nuclear dangers and raise the nuclear threshold so that everybody would have more time before they undertook this kind of god-awful, almost planet-ending kind of military response and action, I would try to do it."
And he did. I think one of the most important pieces of legislation that he got passed was something they called the Cooperative Threat Reduction Act of 1991. And it's very few people know anything at all about it, but over the 10-year period from 1991 forward, they spent about $10 billion to reduce the number of nuclear weapons around the world. Some people may know it as the Nunn-Luger program. Chances are, though, that most of your listeners haven't heard about it at all. But I will tell you that it is, I could easily understand why he thought it was one of the most important bills to be passed under his stewardship, because it really worked. In Ukraine, they succeeded in removing all of the nuclear weapons from there. And people will remember that in 2014, the Russians invaded. And I can only say that I cannot imagine what might have happened if those weapons had still been there. Nancy, the bottom line is they don't give Nobel Prizes for wars avoided, but perhaps they should. That was the way he approached just about everything. He tried to look ahead to see what the problem might be down the road and to plan for it. One senator said to him one day, very cynically, he said, "Well, Sam, be careful. You don't want to solve people's problems before they are aware of what the problem is." And there was a little bit of laughter in the room over that kind of a comment, but Sam Nunn paid no attention. For him, the whole business of public service was to solve people's problems and to look ahead and anticipate problems before they arrive. And I think the Cooperative Threat Reduction Act was one of those great efforts that he had for doing that.
Well, Roland, as I'm reading your book, I really see it as a movie. And knowing how you can write and write speeches and have a quick turnaround for people who say, "Roland, I need a speech," So I think your next step should be to turn this into a screenplay. It's very cinematic, and when I'm reading it, I just got such a kick out of the dialogue. So much of the humor we may not get to talk about, but have you thought about creating a screenplay?
No, you're the one to do this, Nancy. I think you are the one to do this. I have spent a little bit of time in recent years trying to learn how to write a novel, trying to teach myself as much as I could, and to try to listen to other people who have done it and done it well. And one of the things that you learn is how of the importance of dialogue, of course. I mean, the whole story gets told that way, and through the lives and mouths and minds of the characters. And so I've tried to make this a more interesting read by including the dialogue. And most of this dialogue is as it happened. It's not, doesn't come from my imagination, but was real at the time.
Yeah, you're fortunate in that regard, in that you do have actual records that you can quote from.
Well, somebody said, did you keep a diary during this period of time? And I said, no, actually, I did not. But it was such an important period and such a defining period for my career and my service that it stayed with me. A lot of those details that people would normally long have forgotten came back very, very quickly. And I'm pleased to share them with people who might find it of value. And I think that's the whole thing. I wanted to write a memoir that was more than just a story about me, but a story about me with Sam Nunn and the record that he built that was a fine example of public service, something worth emulating.
Well, a part of your book that I think movie audiences would enjoy happened during that same time that Sam Nunn was in Europe. It was the night after the Cuban Missile Crisis was brought to a close, and Sam Nunn had another life-changing encounter. But I want to save that because we need to take a break. And when we get back, I want to ask you what happened to Sam Nunn there in 1962, who he met, and also how you happened to meet Sam Nunn, because until this point in your book, the two of you have not met each other. So I want to ask you about that when we come back from the break, Roland. My guest is Roland McElroy, and he has written a memoir of working with Sam Nunn, the best president the nation never had. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is Roland McElroy, who is former press secretary to Senator Sam Nunn and later his chief of staff. And he has written a memoir of his working with Sam Nunn. And there are many nice things in your book about Sam Nunn, but one of the quotes that I liked was, "Few who serve in Congress today are Nunn's equal in ethical behavior, dedication to the public good, and his enormous intellectual capital." Well, welcome back, Roland McElroy.
And before glad to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah, before the break, I mentioned that something happened while just after the Cuban Missile Crisis when Sam Nunn was in Paris. And what happened?
Well, he was very fortunate to meet a young lady there from Washington State. Her name is Colleen Ann O'Brien, quite a dynamic and vivacious Irish lass. And he was extremely fortunate to meet her, I think. She has been a wonderful partner for him throughout his life. They have two children, Brian and Michelle Nunn. And Michelle, you may recall, ran for the U.S. Senate in 2014. She didn't win, but she certainly left an impact on the people that she met along the way. Today she's CEO of CARE International. So it's quite a family. Colleen, I think I remember the first time we had a real experience with her in the election of 1972 is when we went to Savannah just after he had announced his intention to run for the U.S. Senate. Nobody knew him down there. No, absolutely nobody knew him. And so we told this one single key supporter we had there. I think we only knew this one. And that we needed something, a sign on the side of the car that would really attract people's attention. We thought it would be something with Sam Nunn's name in big, bold letters. And when we got there, it said Colleen O'Brien. And they announced that she would be, you know, sitting in the back of the car in a convertible on the top of it. And in tiny, tiny letters, it said, and her husband, Sam Nunn.
Did you mention the Ziff of St. Patrick's Day?
This was the St. Patrick's Day parade in Savannah. A lot of your listeners may not know that it's the second largest parade, celebration, whatever you want to call it, in the country after New York.
Yes, I didn't know that. I found that very interesting little fact.
It is indeed. And they dye the river green, you know, to go through all of those things. But he really was not well known. There was a lady who came up to him in the parade that day, and she said, well, you seem like a nice young man. I'm glad to meet you, but I don't vote in South Carolina. And I remember hearing that, and he heard it, and he looked at me. We both knew what that meant. We have a long way to go to just crack this thing, not only win it, but just to crack it and try to get some identity. So that was the way we started. Colleen Ann O'Brien, she's been great all these years for him.
And she was already had a rather interesting career before the two of them even met. She was a CIA employee assigned to the Paris embassy when they started dating there in Paris.
Correct. I think she was fluent in French, and the government assigned her over there when they needed that sort of help. And she was working at the embassy when he met her. They came back here after the Cuban Missile Crisis, but he kept up with her, to say the least. And by 1965, they were getting married in Perry.
Well, I also mentioned that after the break, we would find out how you met Sam Nunn, because at this point, the two of you have not met. So, and then he was already married. You got married in 1965, but you don't meet him until 1971. And how did that come about?
Well, it came in Atlanta. I was working in Athens and had a little public relations business over there when the phone rang, and it was Jody Powell on the other end. And he said, we need some help with this Goals for Georgia.
I might
program.
Remind people who Jody Powell was.
Jody Powell was the press secretary for the Governor Carter at that time. And of course, later came to Washington with him and became his press secretary in Washington. But he had a program called Goals for Georgia. It was an exercise in participatory democracy, you might say. We were to go around the state and hold conferences and listen to people and get the people to help him, the governor, set some spending priorities, if you will, for his four-year term in office. But here was, let's see, he was inaugurated in January of 71, and in May, they called me. They were really anxious to get started with this Goals program, and they wanted to know if I was available to do the communications part of it. I told them that I was, and I guess that was before lunch that day, and by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we had concluded our discussion, and they had hired me. And about that time, a young man by the name of Sam Nunn came into Jody's office, and he introduced me to him. and said, you know, this is Sam Nunn from Alston County. You know Perry. Like I wouldn't know the state of Georgia like the palm of my hand. But anyway, that was my first introduction to Sam Nunn. I thought he was an incredibly energetic and curious person about everything. Just, it was so obvious from that very first meeting. And I think the thing, Jody said to him, we've just hired Roland. He said, good. Nunn did. He said, good. Can you get started today?
He had a to-do list.
He said, I have a list of things for you to do. And believe me, he always had a list of things for me and anyone else who worked for him over the years, a list of things to do. But that was our introduction, went from there.
Well, when you describe walking into Jody Powell's office, here's another scene I could see in a movie. You walk in and here's this, he's young, this chain smoker who was lighting one cigarette after another. He's almost setting his office on fire.
Right.
Couldn't find
right.
the ashtray and it was smoking. So how did Jody Powell know to call you? You're over in Athens. You don't have
That's
any record.
And I wasn't involved in politics in those days and not with the Carter political interest. And I was curious about that myself, but I found out that he had called J.W. Fanning, the vice president for services at the University of Georgia, someone that everybody in Georgia, frankly, knew, particularly those in public service. And J.W., I think, had probably seen a television show that I was doing for the Georgia Educational TV network at that time, so he knew of me. And I, for some reason, my name was the first one that came to mind to him. And he's the one who recommended me 9 o'clock that morning. And by 11 o'clock, I was in Atlanta. And by 1 o'clock, I was hired and we were getting started with this other program. But J.W. Fanning was a great fellow. He was the one who founded Leadership Georgia, another program for identifying and cultivating leaders in various communities around the state. But he was a guy who was always giving back and always looking for ways to help University of Georgia graduates kickstart their careers. I'll always be grateful to him for mentioning my name to Sam Nunn that day.
My guest is Roland McElroy. He has written a memoir of Working with Sam Nunn, The Best President the Nation Never Had. Now, so you get right away, you get right down to work. And then you go out to these regional conferences, and this is late summer of 1971. And what happened at one of these regional conferences?
Well, we were in Dublin, Georgia. It was towards the end of the summer and towards the end of our scheduled series of public conferences around the state. And the appointed senator, the one that Carter had appointed to the position upon the death of Senator Richard Russell of Georgia. And he died in January of 71. And so this fellow hadn't been on the job very long by August of that year. And he showed up at one of the conferences. And we wanted those things to be apolitical, but it was the governor's program. And so when he showed up, the leaders of that particular conference decided they would put him up there on the program and let him speak if he wanted to. Well, of course, he did. And after he spoke, they asked Sam Nunn, who was the administrator, you might say, of the Goals for Georgia program, to do his thing, which was to speak as well on the issues that the group was considering. And the two of them spoke back to back. And I remember listening in the back of the room. Hadn't thought about this at all until that moment in time. I mean, I didn't know Gambrell, who was the appointed senator. But as I listened to one and then the other, I thought, there's a huge amount of difference here, even though neither has any charisma whatsoever. I mean, they were both like dead fish. You know, they just didn't come across in a way that made you say, yes, I'd like to hear more from that guy. It just didn't happen. But Sam Nunn finished and he walked to the back of the room where I was standing, and he came over to me, and I could tell he wanted me to say something, and I just blurted out, "You know, if you decide to run, I think you could beat that guy." And he, somewhat startled, gave me a double look, and he said, "I have no idea what you're talking about. What makes you say a thing like that?" And immediately he started to walk away. And of course, watching him, I just thought, he's thinking about something. Something's going on there. I thought he was going to run for Congress. I think the rumor mill had it that if he was going to run for anything, it would be for the House of Representatives. But up to that point in time, we hadn't talked about it at all. And so that day, I thought I would probe a little bit and ask him something that would kickstart that kind of conversation. And he walked away from me at that point in time, and I felt like that he was already thinking about it. So at the end of the conference that day, I decided to get in the car and go back to Athens, go back home. And he stopped me in the parking lot, and he said, "You know, you really think I could win? And do you think I could beat him?" He never said his name, his future opponent's name. He just said, "You really think I could beat him?" And I said, "You could." And he said, then he quickly said, no, I don't think I'm interested. I'm not interested in that." And he kept denying his interest the whole time. And we talked for another half hour. And then finally, I think we just sat down on the curb right there at the Dublin High School where we were having the conference and continued to talk about the possibilities and what we'd have to overcome, the problems and so on that we might have. And we continued to talk until it was nearly dark, as a matter of fact. And I got in the car finally and headed back to Athens, and I thought, oh my gosh, he's really, really thinking about making a run for the United States Senate. And it was an exciting thing to think about. I hoped he would make a run for the House of Representatives at least. I think a lot of his friends thought if he ever ran for anything, he would run for something like that to begin with, or for some state office. But for the U.S. Senate, no. I don't think anybody envisioned that he might make a run for the Senate that year. So it was a foolhardy thing we were supposedly undertaking, according to most people that knew either one of us. But in the end, it worked. We had enough time to get the people of Georgia to know him and to discern in him the qualities of leadership and representation that they were looking for. You know, in the end, you know, he had the support of Coretta Scott King on one end, and George Wallace at the very end on the other end. And, you know, former segregationist governor Marvin Griffin and Lester Maddox. And so it ran the spectrum. And I used to wonder if he could hold that coalition together, and I shouldn't have wondered, because he did. And I think it was held together because, as he once told me, they were all looking for the same thing. Someone who would listen to them, hear their views on issues, hear their problems, and to responsibly address them. Go to Washington, read, study, learn, and make decisions that were in their best interest. And if they didn't agree with him, at least it would be someone who could explain his position and help them to understand their point of view. So they were all looking for the same thing as we should be doing today. Not looking for somebody to walk in lockstep with their party, but someone who would understand that once you get in, you should put partisanship aside and begin to compromise and cooperate with your colleagues in order to move this government forward. That's the only way it moves. It doesn't move any other way. And I think to approach it on anything but a nonpartisan way when you're trying to accomplish something is wrong.
My guest is Roland McElroy. He has written a memoir, The Best President the Nation Never Had, and he is telling about his working with Sam Nunn. And Sam Nunn at this point is trying to decide whether to run. He's just about decided that. And he was asked, well, I'll support you, Sam, but I have a question that'll determine my level of support for you. And he says, Sam, are you willing to give up golf for the next 11 months? And what did Sam say?
There was a pause. Usually there's not a pause, but when you bring up golf and you're questioning whether he's committed to it or not, there's going to be a pause. But there was a pause that day before he finally told a group of us, yes, firmly, he said, yes, he was going to give it up. And all of us in the room found that hard to believe. We all know how much he loved then and loves now playing his game of golf. And for him to say that he was willing to give it up for 9 months, whatever it was going to be at that time, was quite significant. And we knew that he was committed to it. But there was nothing really that was going to dissuade him from making that run once he had made the decision, once he had weighed all the factors that were involved and he had decided to come down on the side of running and made that commitment. There was nothing that was going to dissuade him from that. We had one person who called him, a member of his family, as a matter of fact, a cousin, I think, who said, we've been running for about 3 or 4 months, and this person called on the Sunday afternoon to his house and said, you know, Sam, I'm going to speak to you like your brother and tell you that you need to get out of this race. You can save your reputation. Your family won't be too embarrassed. If you just get out now, you can run again another day, run for lieutenant governor or something like that down the road. And he listened. I think I would have been crushed by it if I'd been running and I'd had a cousin call me that way. But he listened to this fellow and finally hung up the phone and looked at me and said, we've got a lot of work to do. And he wouldn't pay any attention to anybody who tried to tell him you shouldn't run or you should drop out. That's what you have to have. It's like anything you want to do well in life. You've got to have a passion for it and make a commitment to it. And he did, and he's always been that way.
And he expected commitment from his staff. He, Christmas Eve, he asked you to meet to plan this political campaign, and so that was kind of a preview of coming attractions, that you're going to have to sacrifice a lot of your life for Sam Nunn. But you also say it was worth it.
Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding? I mean, this guy went to the U.S. Senate, and regardless of the state, I mean, it doesn't make any difference. He's established a record there that would be the envy of any representative or any senator from any other state. He accomplished quite a bit, and in particular in the area of defense and foreign policy, and not only the Nuclear Reduction Act, but the reorganization of the Defense Department, which came about in landmark legislation in 1986, streamlined the chain of command, made a huge difference in the outcome of the 1991 Gulf War, the first one. I mean, the list of accomplishments, quite frankly, is long. But he did it in a very special way by adhering to the highest ethical standards from the very beginning, being very honest, not allowing anyone to get into his life in the way lobbyists like to do, who want to buy the influence, and they do that very well with a lot of people. But he's always made clear to lobbyists that he was grateful for their support, but not to expect him to vote their way every time, that he would listen, but he was always going to vote the best interest of the people. And he did. He did. I tell you, you know, when people are trying to make up their minds about candidates to support, they ought to look and or ought to listen and see if that person mentions the words public service or public servant. If they don't say those words in the first 2 or 3 minutes that you're talking to them, you might doubt whether that person is specially cut out for that particular public office. It is all about public service. It is all about earning the public's trust before you enter public service. When I have people come to me who are doctors, a lot of them are, lawyers, professionals of all kinds, and they express an interest in running for office, which is good. I mean, the ordinary citizen ought to feel like he could run sometime, but they should be doing it for the right reasons, not for their own special interest, to satisfy some ego. It's not an ego trip, but to serve the public. They should mention the words public service. If they don't understand that that's what it's about, then they should probably look for something else to do. Being an experienced person in any vocation is a good quality. All those other things are good too, if you're whatever the profession you come from. But if you don't understand that you're about to enter a different field altogether, public service, then you probably should think long and hard about getting into it. And if you're the voter, you ought to think long and hard about whether you want to support that person or not. That's my plug for the day, Nancy.
Well, Sam Nunn made that decision, but the campaign didn't get off to a very good start. In fact, shortly after that Christmas Eve meeting, this first day of January, the next year, 1972, the political editor of the Atlanta Constitution wrote in a column the 10 most insignificant news stories of the previous year, and he listed Sam Nunn's, quote, plan to break with Jimmy Carter and run for the U.S. Senate. And so nobody thought that I take that back. Some people who knew his record as a student, like his coach, his teachers, these are people who knew Sam Nunn had what it take to accomplish whatever he set out to accomplish. So in spite of the naysayers, Sam Nunn was going to go ahead with this. It was amusing that some of the things that when you're trying to run a campaign and you think, well, we'll hire these ad men who knew what they're doing, and you discover that many of them knew even less about campaigns than you did. And I was turned the page in your book, and I saw this bumper sticker, and I thought, I can't read some of the letters in this. The critical words, Sam Nunn, I could barely read. What was the matter with that bumper sticker?
We were neophytes in everything that we did, including a simple thing like making a bumper sticker. And it was an old-fashioned paper bumper sticker. They wouldn't do that these days. They're all vinyl, you know, that peel off very well. But it was an old paper bumper sticker, and the red lettering on it, the only thing that was red on it was Sam Nunn's name. Problem was, it was not color fast, and about 2 weeks after they were put on bumper stickers, the red letters completely faded away. And the slogan was, get tough in Washington, put Sam Nunn in the Senate. But when the Sam Nunn part had faded away, it was blank there. And so one supporter called the office to tell us about this problem. And he said, I'm thinking of writing my own name in. And we decided, we told him it was not quite yet the time for him to do that. And we were going to send him some new ones, which we did. But I mean, you know, we made mistakes one after the other, which if you did those kinds of things today, you wouldn't even scratch in a political campaign. There's so much more complicated to run, and so many other ways in which you need to be known before you start. It's very, very difficult for someone with no experience in politics whatsoever to get the traction that he needs quickly enough to make a difference.
So somebody, there's a faulty bumper sticker and you're contacted about that, a billboard design that hides the candidate's face, and so you have to deal with that. What generally were your duties as a staff member?
That's a very good question. I've never really been able to define them. They certainly never did fit under any specific title. And I don't think I ever had a title, certainly not in that first campaign. I was a jack of all trades, a troubleshooter of all kinds, and the guy who was perhaps a professional on the staff who was the closest to Sam Nunn and certainly knew the most about him and his life, his family, his positions on the various issues. And so I had a very full portfolio, but it covered a broad range of issues I guess is the safest thing, safest way to describe it for you.
And he's trying to get coverage in the media, trying to get his name out there. And his wife gets her name in the news because she killed a snake.
You know, the news media are the same today as they were back then. They do like the sensational story. He was out there talking about the issues all day, every day. And while he was making sense in that regard, it wasn't exciting enough to be on the radio or really on the television very much. And he was disappointed in that. But the Associated Press did this story about how his wife had cornered a rattlesnake on the porch out on the farm and had killed this rattlesnake. It quoted her as saying that she shot at least two on the farm every year. So it was a story that was broadcast all over the state. And for months afterwards, people would come up to him and ask him about it and talk about it. It became part of the standard introduction for him at civic clubs. And we had a lot of laughs about that. But it was, I'm sure, disappointing for the candidate that he didn't get more attention on the issues. People were actually paying more attention to his discussion of the issues than he anticipated or that the media reflected in those days.
In fact, one opportunity, there was a televised debate. They just had an hour. This was 10 days before the Democratic primary. And the most remembered remark was when they asked Sam Nunn if he had anything to say. And at the end of this debate, and he says, "Is anyone still watching?"
Yes.
That was the most remembered remark.
It was we had about 14 or 15 people in that debate. It was a wide open contest. And on the Democratic side, if you won the nomination, it was still a Democratic state. So the Republicans took a back seat at that point in time. And it really wasn't, there wasn't enough time for them to get into anything, to a real debate, as a matter of fact. That was discouraging. But at the end, it was had been such a crazy hour-long event that he said, "The real question here is anybody still watching?"
Well, and I hope people will get a copy of your book and read about this ethical person we had in the Senate that was not necessarily charismatic, but served us well. Thank you so much, Roland, for being with me today.
You're quite welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
My guest has been Roland McElroy. His memoir is "The Best President the Nation Never Had." You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is "The Mysterious Barricades" by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.